Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, August 3rd, 2023. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Wildfire blow-up burns ranch buildings along Salmon River in Holdings. Those convicted of simple drug possession under Washington law, State Supreme Court overturned, eligible for refund of legal fees. Spokane voters will cast ballots on new strict anti-camping ordinance in November. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Reports.
Fiber over to programs to expand wireless. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
I'm Christina Honestead reporting for Pacifica Radio.
I'm Max Pringle.
From Feature Story News in New York, I'm William Denslow.
In New York, I'm Sally Patterson.
In London, I'm Simon Gaitan.
In London, I'm Ollie Barrett.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. A wildfire blow-up Sunday in the Salmon River Canyon burned seven structures at the Allison Ranch Ministries Foundation Retreat at Allison Creek and one building at Yellow Pine Ranch. The Lewiston Tribune reports the Elkhorn Fire made a 20,000-acre run with winds up to 90 miles per hour Sunday afternoon. No one was injured. The ranches are surrounded by Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest and Payette National Forest land upstream from Riggins. The Forest Service temporarily suspended boat launches between Corn Creek and Vinegar Creek because of the fire blow-up. They lifted the suspension today, but still say boaters should use caution, and if fire conditions worsen, they will reinstate the boat launch suspension. The Idaho Department of Lands reports its crews have fought 172 wildfires so far this summer. The agency reports eight wildfires are burning in the state now. The Idaho Press reports the two largest are the Elkhorn Fire northeast of McCall and the Hayden Fire south of Salmon in the Lemhi Mountains. The Elkhorn Fire had burned 22,400 acres as of yesterday and was 0% contained. The Hayden Fire had burned 22,000 acres and was 47% contained as of yesterday. The Hayden Fire has injured 14 people. The Little Bear Fire in the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest had burned 1,346 acres and was 15% contained as of yesterday. Two log jams are blocking rafters on the Middle Fork of the Salmon River. According to the Lewiston Tribune website, Salmon Chalice National Forest spokesperson Amy Baumer said no rafters are trapped by the log jams at Velvet Falls Rapid and upstream from Velvet Falls. Baumer said because the jams are in a wilderness area, the Forest Service will not try to remove the log jams and rising water flows will eventually wash them away. For the rest of the rafting season, those running the river will likely have to launch at Indian Creek. Voters in Spokane will cast ballots on a proposed anti-camping law in November's election. The law would make it illegal to camp within 1,000 feet of any school, park, playground, or daycare. Spokane already has an anti-camping law that prohibits camping along the Spokane River and Latah Creek, under viaducts, and within 3 blocks of a homeless shelter. Attorney Brian Hansen, who organized a signature gathering for the initiative, said the law is necessary to protect children. Opponents of the measure say the homeless have nowhere to go. A 2018 decision by the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in a case from Boise says local governments cannot completely ban camping on public property unless there is enough room in local shelters, because criminalizing homelessness among people with no place to go violates the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. The Ninth Circuit decision allows limited camping bans, but because Hansen's initiative would outlaw camping throughout much of the city of Spokane, it may be in violation of the Eighth Amendment because the city does not have enough homeless shelter beds. City Council President Lori Kinnear said the City Council had little choice but to vote to put the initiative on the November ballot Monday because signature gatherers had submitted more than enough signatures from registered voters to qualify. The Seattle City Council voted down Socialist Councilmember Kashama Sawant's rent control proposal this week. The vote on what is Sawant's last likely initiative before she steps down from the council after three terms in December was 6-2. During nearly 10 years in office, Sawant has successfully championed the city's $15 per hour minimum wage and activist-led efforts to tax Amazon. She also successfully fought a recall attempt against her in 2021. The rent control proposal was a trigger bill that would have only gone into effect if the Washington legislature reversed a local preemption law currently in effect that prohibits municipalities from enacting rent controls. The Federal American Community Survey found rent in Seattle had increased 15% between 2017 and 2021, and average rents increased 92% between 2010 and 2020 in the Seattle-Tacoma-Bellevue area. Opponents on the council said the rent control bill would disincentivize housing development in the city and make providing housing unaffordable for smaller mom-and-pop landlords. Rental Housing Association of Washington President Sean Flynn told the council landlords would flee Seattle. Sawant said, "As a socialist, I believe that housing should be a human right, but capitalism turns everything into a commodity, which means that economists discuss issues like rent control not in terms of human beings and our needs, but instead in terms of investor profits." State lawmakers have allocated over $90 million for Washington's Blake Refund Bureau, which will refund legal fees for those whose simple drug possession convictions were overturned by the 2021 Blake decision by the state Supreme Court. The ruling found Washington's simple drug possession law unconstitutional because it did not account for people who unknowingly have illegal drugs on them. Blake was the name of a Spokane woman convicted for methamphetamine possession in 2016. Washington Court Management Division's Administrative Office Director Chris Stanley says the office is aware of 200,000 simple possession drug convictions in the state and estimates more than half of them are eligible for attorney's fees refunds. Those who want a refund must have their convictions vacated before applying for the money. And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
More Native students have options for higher education tuition breaks, but some tribes are left out of this growing movement. States are offering to cover college costs for students from federally recognized tribes, including Oregon, which established the Tribal Student Grant Program last year. However, an estimated 400 tribes across the country aren't recognized by the U.S. government. Natalie Pate, a reporter at Oregon Public Broadcasting, wrote about this issue for the Hechinger Report.
As a result, the Native students who are part of those tribes are not getting the same opportunities as their peers and are left with a disproportionate amount of debt if they do decide to pursue higher education, and many are choosing not to.
The Oregon Tribal Student Grant applies to the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. Individual universities in the state, including Western Oregon University, Oregon State University, and Portland State University, have extended in-state tuition to the more than 570 federally recognized tribes across the U.S. Pate says many tribal members who aren't recognized choose to forgo college because of the cost.
There's definitely this feeling of isolation and separation and feeling like another line has been drawn and they are put on the wrong side of it, or the side that is going to make it so they don't get the same access to education and job opportunities.
Pate notes that Oregon allows members of the Chinook Indian Nation, which isn't currently recognized federally, to access in-state tuition costs. She says some tribes like the Duwamish in Washington have offered financial assistance internally, but more could be done on a greater scale.
In terms of big picture solutions, we're looking at institutions and state leaders trying to find some of those solutions so it can impact as many students who are wanting to go to school as possible.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. Attorney's Office announced a $20,000 fine against Tick Clock Pharmacy in Colfax Tuesday for failure to comply with controlled substance regulations. The Colfax drugstore agreed to the settlement with the U.S. Attorney's Office after admitting to filling prescriptions written by doctors and medical personnel which contained red flags or signs of, quote, fraud, drug-seeking, lack of medical necessity, potential for abuse or health risk, or potential for diversion without appropriately resolving those red flags prior to dispensing the medications, unquote. The fine is said to ensure Tick Clock Drug will comply with the regulations. The Daily News reports the U.S. Attorney's Office said Tick Clock Drug filled prescriptions for various patients which had a potentially dangerous and medically inappropriate combination of the opioid pseudoephedrine, benzodiazepine, and a common muscle relaxant. Ephedrine is a decongestant which is used by illegal drug makers for methamphetamine. According to the settlement, in addition to the fine, Tick Clock Drug entered into a memorandum of agreement with the Drug Enforcement Agency to work to resolve all red flag prescriptions, such as methamphetamine, prior to dispensing a controlled substance. The pharmacy is expected to provide an employee training program to ensure compliance with the 1971 Controlled Substances Act and the Combat Methamphetamine Epidemic Act of 2005. Employees are barred from dispensing a controlled substance to themselves. Tick Clock Drug owner and pharmacist Nathan Johnson bought the business from previous owners and his parents, Mark and Robin Johnson, in January. Johnson said he was aware of the problem when he bought the business. Johnson told the Daily News they began implementing the changes immediately after the agreement. He said the violation stemmed from a series of administrative mistakes, which included not properly separating or dating invoices. Johnson said the penalty is a learning opportunity to be better. He said his staff is well trained and dedicated to the business. He said the store's service to the public will not change and is still, quote, going to offer the best care that we can to each person. It's made us a better pharmacy to help our patients. Prosecutors charged 84-year-old Charles M. Nims of Cul-de-Sac yesterday in Nez Perce County Court with lewd conduct with a minor under 16 years of age. According to the Lewiston Tribune, court documents say a minor child informed Nez Perce County law enforcement saying Nims molested her 9 or 10 times, beginning when she was 5 or 6 years old and ended when she was around 12 years old. Court documents say the minor told police the abuse included physical contact with genitals after Nims allegedly pulled down the child's pants and pulled her on top of him. Court records say Nims told investigators in an interview the minor flirted with him, which made him feel younger, and he said he took her to a Lapway residence 4 or 5 times, intending to have sex with her. Nims told police they engaged in foreplay, which he described as something that happens before having sex, and that he had to stop himself before things got out of hand. Nez Perce County Prosecuting Attorney Nathaniel Rupp asked Magistrate Judge Victoria Olds to set a bond at $250,000 because he said Nims is a threat to the child. Public defender Peyton Lawrence asked Olds for a $50,000 bond. Nims has a Social Security income of $900 per month. Judge Olds granted the state's request on the bond, but told Nims he is legally entitled to ask the bond to be lowered later. If a jury finds Nims guilty of the felony charge, he faces life in prison. 35-year-old Shasta Kringley of Orofino was injured in a single-vehicle rollover crash on Deer Creek Road near Milepost 1 last week. According to the Lewiston Tribune, the Clearwater County Sheriff's Office reported sheriff deputies and the Orofino Ambulance Service responded to the scene following emergency treatment. Crews airlifted Kringley to a hospital with serious but non-life-threatening injuries. In a Wednesday news release, the sheriff's office said the accident is under investigation. The Latah County Human Rights Task Force and the City of Moscow Human Rights Commission are sponsoring the Great Moscow Food Drive Saturday, August 5th, from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. at two locations. The Commission and the task force will collect food at Moscow Farmers Market near Friendship Square and at East City Park at the corner of Hayes and 3rd Streets. Donations of non-perishable food and household and toiletry items are requested and will be given to the Moscow Food Bank and the West Side Food Pantry. Donations of cash and checks will also be accepted, with checks made out to the Latah County Human Rights Task Force. Checks can also be sent by mail to the Task Force at P.O. Box 8613, Moscow, Idaho 83843, or donated on the Task Force website, which is humanrightslatah.org. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, partly cloudy tonight and tomorrow, low 57, high 85. Friday night, widespread haze after midnight, mostly cloudy, low 58. 30% chance of showers Saturday, mainly in the afternoon, widespread haze before noon, mostly cloudy, high 81. A 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms Saturday night, mostly cloudy, low 55. And a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms Sunday, mainly in the afternoon, otherwise mostly cloudy, high 79. Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio. At 7:30, we'll have Appearing Locally, where we will feature music from bands and musical artists that are appearing in the Moscow Pullman area in the near future. Maximum Rock and Roll is on at 8 p.m. and at 9 p.m. We will have the Academy in with the Not Dark Yet show live on the air. And at 11 o'clock, we'll have recordings of jam bands at the Ride till 1 a.m. So stay tuned. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night.
Programming on KRFP is brought to you in part by One World Cafe, specializing in craft coffee, fresh baked pastries, artisan sandwiches, weekend brunch, wine, beer, and cider on tap. One World Cafe has a web calendar for upcoming live events and a campus location in the Janssen Engineering Building.
Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are discussing nonviolent journalism and a new book called Nonviolent Journalism, A Humanist Approach to Communication. Our guests are two of the authors. Pia Figueroa Edwards is from Chile, a former Undersecretary of State of Chile and former environmental advisor to the Minister of Agriculture. Since 2008, she has been co-director of Presenza International Press Agency. Tony Robinson is from the UK and has been an activist for peace and nonviolence. He has been a writer, an editor, and finally a co-director for Presenza International Press Agency, specializing in matters of peace and disarmament. In 2019, he produced the award-winning documentary film, The Beginning of the End of Nuclear Weapons. Pia and Tony, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thank you. Thank you, David. It's great to be here with you and to share it with Tony.
Great to be here.
There will be an event about this book we're going to discuss happening on May 9th in Washington, D.C., and people can find that information at presenza.com. Why don't we tell people about Presenza and how long it's been around and what it does?
Well, it's 15 years. We have been working with this agency, which is completely done thanks to volunteer work. And we are in about 40 or more countries in several cities in the world with teams. We work in 9 languages every day, and you can find us in presenza.com. Maybe Tony wants to add some more.
Yeah, we specialize. We've got a very particular set of themes that we're interested in: human rights, the fight against discrimination, peace, disarmament. All these kind of topics, anything to do with human progress is something that we're interested in covering in Presenza.
Wonderful. It's good to know there is so much human progress. I wouldn't have had any idea. And this book, tell us about the origins of this book. There was a Spanish version and now there is an English one?
Yes, and it's in process to be translated to French, to Italian, to German, and to Greek. But we have the English version finally, and it will come out in New York next week. So it's fresh from the printing house. And it collects our work during these 15 years. But basically, in the journalist schools and universities, they tell you that there is nothing else to write about journalism, that everything has been done already, and that it's a matter of study well in order to apply those principles and do a good job. But it's, for us, it's not like that. The way we see the world, the way we tell the other ones about the world is very important. So it's not an objective job, but it's a very subjective job. That's why we have chosen the way of looking, which is a nonviolent way.
The book, in fact, seems excellent for journalists and journalism students, but maybe even for people who are constantly asking me, where do I find good journalism? Because it tells them what to look for. Who is the book meant for?
Well, I would say that we've targeted it thinking about schools of journalism, university departments, colleges, this kind of stuff, but also for activists in social organizations. Often they're producing press releases, they want to get their messages out, and the way that we approach communication can help anyone really in any of those different settings. So it's really, we've really taken, as you said in the introduction to the book, we've really taken all of our trial and error, all of our successes and failures, all of the work that we have done over 15 years, and we've kind of systematized it down into a methodology, which now we're able to teach. And we first started teaching nonviolent journalism, I think it was back in 2016, in various universities in Ecuador, where Presensa was first legalized. And over the years, we've gathered all of this, all of these tools and resources and ways of thinking about journalism, and we've kind of compiled it into this book, which we are now actually formally teaching to new students.
It's a wonderful book, and it goes from a philosophy of life down to specific examples of good journalism. And it starts out with a definition of violence that's very broad. Can you explain maybe what you mean by violence and consequently by nonviolence?
You go, Tony.
So, violence we traditionally see as the physical acts of violence, or punching people, or wars, or rapes, and these kind of things, which are where someone with their physical force, or a group of people with their physical force, are imposing themselves and actually hurting other people. The definition that we take in nonviolent journalism in Presensa is a definition which was first developed by the South American spiritual guide Silo, and he in one of his speeches in 1969, he broadened it to say that violence is anything which creates pain and suffering in human beings. So it expands from the physical act of violence to other forms of violence, which are economic, psychological, the imposition of a morality on other people. So essentially what happens is that before we get to a physical act of violence, there are all kinds of other forms of violence which lead up to that explosion of physical violence. So what we're interested in doing is uncovering all of the roots to this physical violence, showing what is lying underneath it, and thereby helping to adding to the activists all around the world who are looking for good information on which they can base their own campaigns and their actions. So we start from that broader definition of violence, which for us makes complete sense, because I don't go around punching someone unless I have been subjected to a great deal of psychological stress or economic stress. So that's kind of where we're coming from.
And so part of violence is unjust and harmful structures and systems. And later in the book, you talk about journalism going after not just individuals that are doing harm, but structures, right?
Yes. Yes. For instance, all the females movement, all the feminist movement is claiming to stop the patriarchal violence, which many times it's not yet physical. It ends up in a physical aggression, but it starts with very subtle little jokes and little ironic phrases, you know, that start from the thought that you consider all females someone that is not as important or as equal as men. And that is violence also.
Yeah. There's a bit also still near the beginning of the book on ideological violence that sounds almost like a description of most of the big media outlets out there. If I could just quote this, it says, "The imposing of official viewpoints, the prohibition of free thought, the subordination of the communications media to particular interests, the manipulation of public opinion, propaganda for ideas that are inherently violent and discriminatory, but convenient to the ruling elite." That's a great definition of violence. And you even talk about obedience as a form of violence, which I think to many people's ears would sound like the opposite. But with the example of the Milgram experiments, for example, mm-hmm. too much obedience is violence, right?
Yes, people are not always well equipped to deal with the violence that surrounds them. You know, we are trained since birth to accept the conditions that surround us, to not question them. And so when someone in a position of authority, someone comes along, they wear a lab coat and they say, please do this, please do the other thing, then people feel, oh, well, you know, I'm not sure that I'm qualified enough to say yes or no in those situations. We kind of lost that connection with that in inner voice within us that knows what's the difference between right or wrong. We know when we are treating other people the way that we don't want to be treated. Yeah. And yet somehow we are told to kind of ignore those signals coming from within and just follow what the outside reference is saying to us. And we're, you know, nonviolent journalism is also about kind of an awakening, an internal awakening to all of the violence which is happening in the world and saying, right, we don't have to accept it. We can organize ourselves and we can do something about it.
Another element I love about your work and about your account of it in this book, Tony Robinson and Pia Figueroa, is that nonviolent journalism reports on nonviolent activism, which is generally left out. And the notion that nonviolent activism ever accomplishes anything is generally left out of other media, right?
Yes. We are in contact with so many movements all around the world. All around that move the world in that direction. Maybe not to the media; they don't reach the media. But from Greta Thunberg, you can see all the young people moving in the environment. You can see in all the feminist movement so many women. You can see in the farmers in India, for instance, the huge movement they have to protect their rights and to protect water and their carbs, yeah? So many movements, indigenous movement here in Latin America that claim for their rights and that they take care of the environment in a different way. Well, really the majority of the people is rather in this kind of activities more than in the power thing, no? But the news never go to them. They never have the voices in the programs or space in the TV, you know?
Yeah.
Very little.
A media outlet like the Washington Post will tell you once every 10 years, they'll tell you that there was some activist rally or march yesterday. They'll never tell you there's one next week. They'll tell you a bill was voted on, but they'll never tell you a bill is going to be voted on next week. Here's what you can do about it. They'll say that would be participating in activism.
Yes.
What do you say to that?
Well, I would say that, you know, one of the principles that we talk about in the book is the fact that we're beyond journalism. We're part of a current of activism, and I think it's very important to disabuse ourselves of the idea that any form of media, any form of communication, can be objective. Yeah, that objectivity doesn't exist. Every media organization out there has an agenda. They have paymasters. They have people who are telling the people working in those media organizations, you can write about that, you can't write about that. And I think that, you know, the great example going on at the moment with this Nord Stream pipeline, which was blown up by the US government, if you believe Seymour Hersh's account. Which, you know, why would anyone doubt Seymour Hersh's account, given his history in journalism? And yet there are people, senior people in media organizations who are saying, don't talk about any of that. Well, to start with, you might think, well, you know what, these media organizations, they're just being negligent. They're being, you know, not being careful. They're not thinking clearly. But you have to come to the conclusion that it's deliberate, that the media out there are deliberately withholding information that they don't want the public to know about. So, you know, along comes Presenza and we say, we don't, you know, we're practicing nonviolent communication. So what does that mean? We're going to very much put our heart on our sleeve and say, these are the kind of things that people should know about. This is how you can get involved. If you want things to change, these are the kind of actions. And, you know, by publishing a story about a group in rural Peru who have found a way in order to improve something in their community can be inspiring for another community in Namibia who, until they've read about this thing in Presenza, have not been exposed to that idea. So, you know, that's kind of where we're coming from with this, David.
Yeah. In this wonderful book, Nonviolent Journalism, there is also a wonderful introduction by Jan Oberg, who actually writes in support of the word objectivity. But I think what he means by it, as many people might, is accuracy, professionalism, doing a good, serious job, where nonviolent journalism clearly welcomes a point of view or even multiple points of view, right?
Just tell us what your point of view is. I mean, don't give us information and without telling us your point of view, because otherwise, you know, how do we know the criteria on which you have chosen the information to give me? We're very clear. You know, we're going to publish stuff which is going to help the benefit of all of humanity, which is going to help stop wars, which is going to help people have freedom of thought and expression, and all these kind of things. So, yeah.
It's almost opening a door to dishonesty to make a reporter pretend not to have a point of view while obviously writing from some point of view, right?
Correct.
It's impossible to do it without a point of view, because we have, each one of us has an internal world, an internal landscape, a way of being formed, some values. We look for a future in a certain way, and all that constitute our internal landscape is the filter with which we filter reality. I look at reality in a different way than you look, because we have different positions in the world, in our families, in our countries, in our culture. So all that acts, whether I like it or not, in any act of my life. So it's better to study which is the landscape, my internal landscape, the landscape of formation in which I was formed and from where I look at the world, and make it explicit, yeah? And make it obvious as the subjective filter with which I will do my job.
And part of the idea of nonviolent journalism, according to this book, is to include lots of other people's points of view, first person accounts from people who are usually left out or are victims or are activists, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing that happens, David, is that in the measure that you practice this kind of journalism, you need to change your own point of view. You need to overpass your own violence. You discover it. You realize that you exert violence also, and you need to overpass it in order to go forward. So it transforms yourself at the same time. Yeah.
An excellent idea. There's also a principle articulated in the book that information should be public. And there's examples like COVID research, better public than for profit and kept secret for no good reason, etc. Government secrets, presumably lots of them, because you support whistleblowers and truth tellers rather than, as we've seen with the Pentagon's latest leaker, the media outlets that use the stories, nonetheless going after the source of the information on behalf of law enforcement. But what about, you know, what about nuclear secrets? What should be public and what shouldn't be public?
I think that there's a question like where does information come from? Yeah, who owns information? It's, you know, where, you know, because we don't, without some hominids 2 million years ago banging some rocks together and learning how to discover fire, you know, how to make fire, you know, we wouldn't be where we are now. Should we all be paying a copyright to those hominids? You know, because in today's world, that would be what happened. If we didn't have fire now and someone invented it, it would be copyrighted and we'd have to pay for it. Yeah? So all the knowledge that we have is built up. It's an accumulation of knowledge by every single inhabitant of this planet that has ever lived. We all have a common ownership of everything that has been discovered until now. So for some people to hold on to that information and use it to make other people die, which is essentially what they're doing, then, you know, until we can bring down that whole purpose, we're not going to be enable, you know, the development of humanity so that every single human being on this planet can live a dignified life.
An excellent goal for journalism. The introduction to the book, I mentioned critiques existing corporate major journalism that falls short and looks at the corporate consolidation, the echo chamber, the lack of experts, et cetera. I mean, is it getting worse and worse?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely, everywhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. You just have to, I mean, I live in the UK, so you could, you know, everyone respects the BBC. It's a, you know, it's this kind of like monolithic, fantastic media organization. But, you know, the way that they have treated anyone in the UK, which is working towards a better standard of living for everyone, they are just absolutely either ignored or they are hounded out of public life. And it's a tendency which is getting worse and worse. The right wing all around the world are the owners of the mainstream media, and they decide what goes in on the agenda, on the news agenda, and they don't care who they offend in the process.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I live in Chile, in a South American country, very far away from the UK. And we had a referendum some months ago in order to vote for a new proposal of constitution, a great, great work. And we obtained just 38% of approval because of the intense, really intense campaign of the media, especially the big medias that are the ones blamed as the responsibles of this refusal, of this failure.
Yeah.
Rejection. So yes, the media had a tremendous influence, and they work for their interest, basically for their economical interests. They are very conservative. Yes.
Yeah, Oberg says he's writing about global trends and specifically Scandinavian, where he's from, and he complains about when he's quoted in the media as a peace activist, how they frame it and correct it and so forth. But I'm still jealous because in the United States, nobody's quoted as a peace activist at all, right? So there are degrees of this.
But, yes. But,
which is why we publish all of your articles religiously. Yes. For censor, David.
Thank you. He also writes about how these corporate media outlets don't report on war. They participate in war. They take a side.
Right. And
this is the very hardest thing for anybody to do, is to oppose both sides of a war. How do you do that as a journalist?
Well, I think you have to look for the information. You have to look for what's going on, really on the ground. You have to, and you have to put context to it, because a war doesn't come out of nowhere. A war, you know, the way that this, everyone has been talking about, the mainstream media have been talking about the Ukraine war, is the unprovoked war in Ukraine. Yeah. They have to use the word unprovoked to try and make you think that it's unprovoked, because it's clearly a provoked war. You know, it goes back, you know, 30 years to the end of the Cold War, when, you know, NATO started to need a new bad guy in order to justify its existence. And so you can't understand the situation which is happening in a conflict if you don't look at the context of it. And you can't advance in negotiations of any kind unless you put all that context on the table and you say, right, Ukrainians need security, Russians need security. None of those people living in that area are particularly interested in killing each other, unless someone else comes over here and says those people are trying to steal what you've got. Yeah, and that's what's going on in that region. So we, through nonviolent journalism, and also this builds on the work of peace journalism, which has been developed by Galtung and many others over the years. You know, it's a new way of reporting about events which enable people to have a better information with which to then form an opinion about that event.
Should one of the goals of journalism be to create dialogue and interchange and exchange of ideas as opposed to the name calling and pie throwing that we see on television? And if so, how do you do that?
Yes, one of the principles that we sustain is the need of reconciliation. Nonviolent journalism points towards reconciliation in the conflicts. And we try to sit people together in the same table, around the same table, and let them talk. And we try to interview one and then make another interview of the other side and put both points of view together. That's a great job that we can do as journalists to help dialogue and look for a deep reconciliation. One of the processes we followed the most near was the peace process in Colombia, which was a very, very intensive and long process looking for peace until they arrived to the peace agreement. And the implementation of that agreement has been always also followed up by Presenza. Yeah.
Just the act of reporting on peace negotiations happening in Yemen or in Ethiopia or where Sudan, it's not usually reported on. There's a war, and then there's not a war, but there's no coverage of how peace is negotiated.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. With Colombia, we follow up very near all the talks held in Cuba. And also we had long interviews with the people going there, you know, to sit in the tables of negotiation. That is very important because it's a lesson for the rest of the world. I would invite to come to the Washington presentation in May 9.
This should be May the 9th, 5 p.m. at Bus Boys and Poets at 14th and V Streets in Washington, D.C. But people should be able to find it at presenza.com and worldbeyondwar.org.
Yeah, and of course, you know, anyone who's interested in the work that Presenza is doing can visit us at presenza.com. We are currently in the English language team. We are currently in our second course of nonviolent journalism, and we will be holding more courses in the future. But, you know, we have an email address, training at presenza.com, if anyone listening to this wants to find out about it, and we can put them on the mailing list for the next course. Everyone's more than welcome.
I expect a lot of people will. That's wonderful. We have been speaking with Tony Robinson and Pia Figueroa Edwards, who are co-directors of Presenza, and you can find it at presenza.com. The book is called Nonviolent Journalism, A Humanist Approach to Communication. Pia and Tony, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much. David. Thank you so much.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.